Hello, I want to welcome you. This is Brian Reamer. This call is titled Stealth Engagement, the Hidden Motivators that Drive Performance. This meeting comes about as a response to or a continuation of a workshop that I did for the Massachusetts ISPI meeting about a month ago, titled Stealth Engagement, the Hidden Motivators that Drive Performance. Our intention at that time was to talk about some of the motivators besides rewards and punishments that we are often not aware of, but that can have a big impact in the workplace and also in our homes and just individually. So my intention today is to take a few moments and review what we talked about then, open the phone lines for people to ask questions or to share their experiences with intrinsic motivation up to this point. And then I'd also like to share some things about rewards that make them problematic in some situations. And I'll say more about that as we continue on. So for right now, I'm going to mute everybody who is on the call, and then I will unmute you at the time of the time for questions. So okay, so when we met a couple of weeks ago, several weeks ago, I said that the hidden motivators really fit into the categories of A, B, C, and D: autonomy, belonging, competence, and destiny. So I want to talk a little bit about each of those, refresh your memory a bit, and then, as I said, offer an opportunity for some questions. So if you're looking at the handout on the first page, to the left, there's a purple box that says autonomy, and I've got about four bullet points there. And one of the points that I really want to emphasize is that first one, which is that the person who makes the choice is almost more important, or usually more important, than the choice that is actually being made. So if you think back to instances where someone has asked you to do something, if they said it in a way that gave you an option of yes or no, or an option of when, or an option of how, you were probably more likely to do it than if someone told you or ordered you or dictated that you do it. And this is true for us as adults especially, but I think you can see examples of that for young people, for young adults, for children as well, that they tend to be more responsive and more motivated when they've made the decision themselves, even if it's a small decision. And the other thing I want to emphasize, too, is that with autonomy, we're not saying whatever you want to do is okay, because all of us live within limits. And the limits can be time, they could be resources, they might be intelligence or skill. There are all sorts of resources upon each of us about any choice that we make. But it's also true that even within those constraints, there often are choices that we can make. So even if something has to be done by a certain time, there's some autonomy in actually when we start or when we finish, or whether we do something small first and then start on the big task. So if we can choose when we do something or if we choose the method to do it, we feel a little bit more autonomous and a little bit more motivated than if someone says, you must do it the way I tell you and when I tell you to do it. That gets to kind of the third point, that we prefer to make choices on our own, even if they're little choices. And the perception of being autonomous is as important as actually having lots of autonomy yourself. So that's a good thumbnail representation of autonomy. When we speak of belonging, we're really talking about acceptance and our need for social connection to other people. And that connection is really essential to our self-confidence, to our sense of security, our sense of safety, and our willingness to do something. So if you can imagine a time that you were in a strange group, an unfamiliar surrounding, a different culture, people that you just didn't know very well, you may have been less likely to step out and do something or to participate even. And the other corollary is that once we become accepted by a group and feel connected to members of a group or an individual, if it's not a whole group, We tend to make changes for those people that we like, who care about us, who we know respect us, and that we have respect for them as well. So we often talk about peer pressure, and I think that's exactly what peer pressure is. It's wanting to follow and be part of a group, wanting to be connected, and that's a really strong motivator. If you think about your own experience or maybe the experience of other young people you know, peer pressure is a huge thing, and it accounts for some pretty, sometimes, some unreasonable behavior that people have, but they do it because they want to belong to a group. If you scroll down on your page, you'll see a green box for competence. And in some ways, competence is one of the most basic intrinsic motivators, because we're not going to be motivated to do something if we don't have the ability, if we don't have the skill to do it. So there's this little voice in the back of my head that often tells me that I should be doing sit-ups. I don't know why that voice is there, and I kind of wish it wasn't, because I don't like doing sit-ups, and I don't feel that I do them well, and I can't do very many of them. And so I tend not to be motivated to do that kind of an exercise. There are other exercises that I do a lot because I like to do them, and I know that I do them well. So we're less likely to focus on something and spend a lot of time on it if we don't feel that we do it well, or if we just don't know how. And sometimes, as you see the last bullet in that set, a lack of motivation, what appears to be a lack of motivation may actually be a lack of ability. So you're not going to do something that you don't think you do well. Also, I think particularly in a group setting, you're less likely to participate in something and be motivated if you think you might be judged by your ability to do that thing. So if you don't do something well, that's not sometimes a non-starter for motivation. On the other hand, if you are competent at something, you probably do want to do that because you get a sense of recognition by the group or by other people for doing that thing. And if we can structure work and activities or learning or whatever it is in such a way that people can demonstrate their competence, or if they can increase their skill level or competence at something, they're likely to be more motivated. So our last intrinsic motivator, internal motivator, is destiny. And this, I think, in some ways is very much the most powerful type of motivation, internal motivation. And we see its evidence in sometimes in life and death situations. If you think about people who have completed a very difficult physical activity, like mountain climbing or even just camping in the wilderness, that sense of destiny, that there's an internal reason they're doing that. They want to accomplish something. They want to achieve recognition or greatness in that way. Or sometimes people just feel like they have something they want to share. They're a good artist. They want to share their skill. They're good at mathematics, and they want to share their skill in accounting. And they know that it's not just about numbers if they're doing accounting. It's they're doing accounting for some greater purpose, for an organization that they believe in, for a mission that they think is important, or for some kind of personal goal or aspiration that fits with who they are and who they want to be in the world and what kind of a difference they want to make. So I think I hope that's a good summary of some of the things that we talked about before. I'm going to turn the mute off, and it will be a little bit of I don't know if there's going to be some sort of competition or something, but if you have something to say, why don't you go ahead and speak up, and we'll just see what happens. If we have too many voices in the process, someone will have to bow out, but we'll have a chance for everyone to speak. So I heard some rustling at someone who has a phone number. I don't have names on these, but the last four digits are 4600. Do you want to say something, or have someone have a question that they'd like to raise?
This is Joan.
Yes, Joan.
I I was intrigued by the competency as a help desk person in IT. The competency is something that we strive for, but these are often tasks that people aren't doing on a regular basis. So that's why they call us, because we're the expert on that particular thing they only need to know once. So I'm trying to figure out a way to make our clients more competent and not have to call us. And figure out a way to do that so that there's, and I think our knowledge base is going to make that difference.
And is that a knowledge base that's available to your customers?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be a great thing to be able to do. And if there are ways that you can point people to that knowledge base, or if there's a set of frequently asked questions that mm-hmm. might lead in a logical progression to a certain set of the competency or set of the information that you have on that knowledge mm-hmm. base, that might help them to find it themselves.
Yeah.
Another thing that strikes me, and I don't know what other constraints you have, but just as an off-the-wall suggestion, if you wanted to employ some sort of gamification, it might become the elements of it suggests to me the elements of a game that might progress people, you know, on sort of a treasure hunt
mm-hmm.
that would lead them to the information that they need. Sort of, is this happening? Then try there, or that sort
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Right, and that's a big thing that's happening in the industry right now, because the software that we're using, Right Answers, actually is addressing the gamification of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think gamification is really interesting because I think in many ways people are using or the elements of that they're calling gamification or they're using to create a playful atmosphere do fit into these intrinsic motivators. And they also rely a lot on rewards from what I've seen, and we'll see some of the downside of that when we talk a little bit further today. But it's not a bad idea, and taking a playful approach tends to tap into more of these intrinsic motivators. So, great. Is there anyone else with a question or a comment or an example of when you've used some of these intrinsic motivators?
Brian, this
yes.
is Sabine. I was
yes.
curious about the belonging vector.
Yeah.
And wanted to raise the notion of small groups within larger groups and when belonging becomes counterproductive as a source for competition or something where the whole is diminished by the efforts of the smaller group?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, Sabine, and it's one that people don't often raise, but I think it is very important. So there's the in-group and the out-group, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what I hear you talking about is that if you do that, all these team-building sorts of things and have this kind of rah-rah attitude for this one small group, what does that do for the rest of the organization and the other little groups that are going on there? And I would point you to a book by Clifford Nass. I believe it's Nass, but it's called The Man Who Lied to His Computer. And it's... And if you send me an email, I can send you a direct link to that or the reference. The gist of the book is that the computers were used for some valuable research. And what they found was that it was helpful to have in-group identification. So you do things to help your group feel like a strong group. But you also need to do things to help all of the groups feel like one group for the organization. So we might be the group that does marketing and that other team is the group that does customer service, and we each have our own identity, but we also have a shared identity for the whole group. So we're not working for against each other. We work for each other within our team, but we also have cross-departmental references. Another book related to this is Bowling Alone, a book about social groups across society, but making the point that there are bonding relationships within a small group, but there need to be bridging relationships between the different groups so that you don't have that us versus them kind of situation.
So, thanks.
Shoot me an email, and I can, or anyone can shoot me an email if they want more specifics on either of those. Let me at this point move on to the second page of the handout that we have. And what I've done is I've taken a summary of some of the points about rewards and some of their problems from a book called Punished by Rewards by Alfie Cohn. And Alfie Cohn studied under B.F. Skinner, who's the father of a lot of what we know about behaviorism. And Alfie really departed from that, and you can see his departure if you look at this handout. And so one of the things that Alfie says is that rewards often punish people, so that instead of people feeling like their reward is a great thing. I mean, one person gets the reward, everybody else loses. And sometimes we set it up so that more than one person gets an award and reward, and that's a little bit better. But for those of us who don't get the reward, who came in a couple of points short, then there's nothing for us. And so that, in that sense, it's a punishment. Also, rewards rupture relationships. By this, he means that when there's someone in control of the rewards, they actually have control of our behavior. And that's not necessarily a healthy thing to have, a healthy relationship to have. It doesn't necessarily promote the kind of collegiality that we need to have in our work environment. Thirdly, sometimes rewards ignore reasons, meaning that sometimes there's not really a connection between the reward and the behavior. And we do this all the time with children, so I'll use a brief example of that. But if I say to my young daughter, get in the car right away so that we can leave, and if you do it right away, we'll stop at the ice cream store on the way home. Well, what's the relationship between ice cream and getting in the car? I mean, okay, we have to be in the car to get to the ice cream, but that's not why I want you in the car in the first place. You know, we probably need to get you to school or to a doctor's appointment or something like that. So if there's a reward, it needs to be contingent upon what the behavior is that you want. Also, rewards discourage risk-taking. And what this means is if we have a system set up such that maybe we get we have a certain sales goal, and if you get 10% above the sale, you get a reward of some type. Well, it doesn't really, once someone reaches that 10% and they get the reward, there's no reason to go further. Perhaps they could have gone sold 20 or 30% above the average, but once they get to that point of the reward, there's no reason to do more. So it kind of stifles innovation, it stifles people's potential and the chance to take risks and to do something a little different. Lastly, rewards can kill interest when they are applied to something that people are already doing that they want to be doing. So if I'm working for an organization and I see, you know, maybe my task has something to do with marketing or sales, but I see there's something on our website that needs to be fixed, and I take the initiative and fix that. I've done that on my own because I like to do it. If someone says to you, hey, Brian, you did a wonderful job fixing that, we're going to start paying you to fix all the funny things on our website, I may be less willing to do that it may be less fun for me. Maybe I may be less motivated because, again, it's that competence piece. I was demonstrating my competence. I might appreciate having someone recognize that I did that, but if I am paid for it, then my interest may decrease. So that's a lot of information on that second page. Let me take the mute off again and see if any of you have questions that I might be able to answer on that. So you should be able to raise a question if you wish. So I don't hear people clamoring to make an announcement or ask a question or make a comment. Let me direct you then to the bottom of that second page where I've written down some additional resources. These are different, somewhat different than the ones that I had on my handout for the ISPI meeting last month, but one that I encourage you to look at is Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's creativity. He talks a lot about, or interviews a lot of people who are creative in all sorts of fields, not just the arts, but sciences and economics, psychology, mathematics, teaching, so forth, and gets into their head about what makes them creative. And he talks about this system of flow, or flow thinking. And when we analyze what flow thinking is, it really has a lot to do with autonomy, being able to make choices about what you do, being competent, and being able to act and make your or increase your own level of skills, also the sense of belonging and connection with other people, and destiny as well. The next book on the title is Edward Deci as a primary author. It's Why We Do What We Do, a very readable book. Edward Deci and Richard Ryan, the next person on the list, are the initiators of self-determination theory of motivation. Their website is listed there. It's www.selfdeterminationtheory.org. They apply this theory to all sorts of different aspects of our society, from business to education to sports and to other areas. They identify three things as internal, intrinsic motivators: autonomy, mastery, and belonging, I believe it is. So autonomy is one we've talked about. Mastery has to do with competence, and belonging, of course, has to do with connection to other people. I myself have added the notion of destiny because I've, you know, in reading works by people who've been through harrowing incidents in their lives, and the motivation that they found to do that really had a lot to do with their sense of larger purpose and meaning in life. One of those people is the next author on the list, Viktor Frankl. His book, Man's Search for Meaning, is a must-read if you're at all interested in intrinsic motivation and this sense of destiny and why am I here kind of thing. Why am I on the planet? Alfie Kohn's book, Punished by Rewards, we've referred to. And the last one on the list is Dan Pink, Drive. He, too, highlights a lot of what Deci and Ryan say in their self-determination theory. He pulls in work from lots of other theorists and researchers, and he also has a lot of practical, specific changes one can make to tap into the intrinsic motivation that we have individually as well as within an organization. So let me unmute you all again if there are. If there are other questions, I'd be happy to listen to them at this point. I'm not hearing anyone who has a question, but I really want to thank all of you who joined me today. This just about wraps up the 30 minutes that we had scheduled, and I don't want to take more of your time if I don't need to. If you have other questions that do come up, you are welcome to give me a call or send me an email, brian@thefirefly.org. If you want to access this number or access this the recording of this call, you can call the playback number, which is 712-775-7029. Again, 712-775-7029. And you can probably just request to hear the most recent recording. Otherwise, if you have trouble getting that again, send me an email. Once more, thank you so much for joining me on this call. And feel free to give me an email if you have further questions. Best of luck in your own personal motivation and the motivation of those that you work with. Thanks so much for joining me, and have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you.